Sonny, we're on here.
All right.
And I now have on the phone Sonny Osborne. I heard your dog barking. Did you corral your dog?
Oh, yeah. That's an everyday thing. I can't keep her mouth shut and don't want to. She's a little black and gold rat terrier, and meaner than you can ever imagine. She's always been that way, and she protects this house like it's gold. It's her life, and I don't want to stop her from doing that.
Oh no!
And if I have to text her and say, "Hey, I'll be back in a minute," and control my dog, and I'll do that.
All right. Oh, that's fine. That's fine. We were talking right before we went on the air that there's some nice photographs floating around right now by our friend Carrie Antes when we were taking some pictures to use. I think I use them to promote this show a little bit, and we were just asking whether you got them. They're spread all over Facebook now, so you're going to be famous from Facebook alone, even though you never go there. They're traveling around.
I don't go there.
I know you don't. You know how many people always ask me, why isn't Sonny on Facebook? I said, because he doesn't want to.
Well, I don't get on that well with people.
I always tell him, if you want to pass a question to Sonny, go on Banjo Hangout, and you can find him there every once in a while.
Find him there or here.
There or here, that's right. Hey, we were, did you watch UK last night? Then we'll get on to some other stuff here.
I did, yeah, I did. And I was very impressed with the first half. Although, I don't know, they're still just kind of feeling the way. But
oh, yeah.
You're 18, 19 years old. We expect old big things out of and all like that. They're children. For crying out loud. They're children. And, give them a month and a half or something like that, and I'll guarantee you he'll have them playing like champions again,
You remember last year, that team was very raw and very unpredictable, and they had those gaps where they would play really well, then they would quit because of their youth. They didn't know what to do next to put a team away. I think that's what happened last night.
Sure thing. Absolutely.
Hey, I was... go ahead.
I was impressed. They've got three guys on there, and I guarantee you before they're done, they'll be All-America, and they've got another guy that reminds you of that kid Gilchrist from last year.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
6'7 or 6'8 and just a monster man. Wow. I mean, he's really good.
Who's up next? Good. Is Duke next week?
Duke is Tuesday.
Yeah, ooh, that'll be.
That'll be a hard sell.
Well, if they have that gap in concentration, they're not going to hold off Duke like they held off Maryland, you know.
No. Duke's got a coach that knows what to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, we were earlier in the week I mentioned to you that I start this show every show at 2 o'clock comes on Benny Martin, Smell Good on Sunday. Now, it's kind of a novelty song for him, but... it starts off the show because he talks about, you know, getting cleaned up for Sunday. And since it's Saturday, I kick off that way. And there was something on Banjo Hangout where you were talking about Benny Martin. I thought maybe we could chat a little about Benny's playing and maybe talk about fiddle players and just kind of go from there a little bit.
Well, fiddle players in general are just about half crazy.
All right.
Banjo players are the same way. They really are. There's a different kind of mentality, attitude toward those two instruments. I don't know why it's like that, but doggone it is. It really is. And all except me, of course.
You're not half crazy. That's true.
No, I'm not half. I'm a full blood.
You are full fledged.
Yeah, I am. But Benny Martin was just a wonderful fiddle player. I mean, he was just about as good as you can get. During the time, he worked with Johnny and Jack, and then he worked with Flat Scruggs. And they were so good, it was unreal. I mean, they really were just very, very good. But Danny had some real, he had some really funny quirks. He did. I don't know how you say this, but when he recorded those songs with us, he had been, let's say he was out late the night before.
He was tired.
It was a little more tired. He did those two songs, and he just said, "Boys, I just can't do it," and he left. The one, "Hey Hey Bartender," you can hear in there he gets really tangled up, and he loses concentration. And then on the other one, today has been a lonesome day, I think it is, which it turned out to be a great fiddle break. I mean, absolutely great, but right in the middle of it, he was lost on where he was. And he worked out of it to the point of where that it sounded absolutely impossible to do. And it's just a great break. It really is a good break. There's so many things. His best playing was on the old Flat and Scruggs radio shows, the Martha White shows, that I guess a lot of, I'm not talking about the TV, I'm talking about the radio shows, from WSM around at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was really some great playing.
He really had a big, I mean, am I wrong on that, or is just the way I hear him? He had a big sound, a big tone, kind of aggressive.
Yeah, it was wide.
There you go.
And he just gave the impression that, like he was saying, "Okay, look out, I'm here, and this is as good as it's going to get, and you won't ever hear anything any better." And it was just not like that. He played on one song, I think it's on those tapes, it's called 2 o'clock, and man, it's really fast. And he and Earl, of course, I always thought that each one of them made the other one a better player. Each one of them did, because they played off each other. And when Benny would do a really great thing, Earl would come back and do that too. He recorded with them, like "Dear Old Dixie," "Flint Hill Special," "If I Should Wander Back Tonight," "Why Did You Wonder," "Dim Lights, Thick Smoke." He recorded some of the prettiest, best stuff that they ever did. Benny had his own unique way of playing, doing things. And I don't know if you knew this or not, but Benny had his own deal on Mercury Records at one time. Hmm. And was a member of the Opry for a short time until he drank his way out. And he had some really good songs on Mercury that he wrote. "Ice Cold Love" was one of them. But the strange thing about it, Benny played the guitar on those sessions, and he hired Dale Potter to play the fiddle. And Dale sounds as much like Benny as you can get. He didn't normally, but I would guarantee, I don't know this for a fact, but I would almost bet that Benny said, "This is the way I want you to play it." And he played it that way. And it sounds just exactly like Benny. I mean, it really does. You get your records out and find "Ice Cold Love," and I can't remember the titles of the other one, but the fiddle playing just sounds—it's just unreal. And if Dale Potter playing the fiddle on it, though, that's the same thing as Ronnie Millsap, who's a great piano player. When he would do his recording, he got Pig Robbins to play piano on his record.
Oh yeah,
I always thought that was funny, but I mean, you know, that's just how they did things.
Well, why did Benny? Did Benny just want to show people that he could play the guitar?
No, he played guitar, and he was good.
Oh.
He had a triple off 45 Martin, and he was a good guitar player. He was, I mean, I'm not saying that he middled himself by playing the guitar, but he was a good guitar player, very good. And I think the way Benny's thinking was that I can show somebody how to play the fiddle and make it sound just like me, but I can't get somebody to play the guitar like me. And that was about true, too. But Benny was a tremendous guitar player. He had some of Darn's quirks, I swear. He always thought, and he made no secret about it. He thought the mafia was after him.
Maybe they were.
He thought that the boys from Chicago was definitely after him, and he felt that way his whole life. I mean, from the time I knew him anyway, he just felt like that they were after him for some reason. I always said, Danny, why do you think they won't mess with you? And he just, that's all he'd do. it's just say, oh, it's so bad that you don't want to know. Or either, you know, that type of thing. And I remember one time we were playing, Ronnie Reno was playing with us, Benny and Don Reno had done some things together as Don Reno and Benny Martin. And so they knew each other quite well. It was somewhere in North Carolina, right out of Raleigh, I think. And we were doing this festival, and it was dark. And we were just kind of walking back there, me and Ronnie, and I don't know who else, Bobby maybe, and Dale Sled or somebody, was just walking in back to the I hear this thing, hey, Ronnie boy. And he looked over there, and it was Benny. And so he came over and was talking, you know, and he said, Ronnie, you see that guy standing right over there? And there was a man standing about 30, 40 feet from us. And this guy, he was looking the other way.
That's a sure sign you're from the mafia.
Oh, yeah. This guy was looking the other way. He wasn't even looking at us. And he didn't know we were there. Then he said, you see that guy standing over there? And I said, well, yeah, Benny. He said, that guy don't know it, but he don't have got a couple more minutes to live. He said, I've already told Frank and the boys, so they're sending their men down here now. They're running now. Oh, my gosh. I mean, it was just like that. That's the way he was. And it was John Hartford was, Danny was John Hartford's closest friend. I mean, that was his greatest friend, and John played the fiddle and played a lot of Benny stuff and could do it too, pretty good. And I had a car. Well, I bought an 86 Cadillac, Fleetwood, and I hated that car from the minute I got it. I didn't like that car, and it sat in the garage. And this was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years later. And that car didn't have hardly any miles on it at all. I just didn't like that car. The engine was too small there. And you just had to push it everywhere. But the car was too heavy for the engine. Anyway, John was sitting here at the house one day, and he said, man, I gotta go buy me a car. And I said, John, I've got just the car for you. And he said, really? And I raised the garage door and showed him that car, and he just absolutely went batty over that car. And so he said, man, I want to buy that car. And I said, okay, you can do that, and I'll be glad for you to have that car. And he bought the car, and he came to pick it up, and there was a little pearl insignia with my name on it inside on the dash of that car. That was kind of inlaid in that dash of that car. I said, I'll get that off. And he said, oh, no. That's part of the deal. I want that to stay there. And I said, well, okay. Big thing. It don't matter to me one way or the other. I just thought maybe you wanted it gone. And he said, no, I want that on there. So he bought the car. I saw John Tolbury, I'd say 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, and he said, you know, when I picked that car up, he said, you don't know what I did after that. I said, oh, I know. And he said, well, I got that car, and everything was taken care of. And he said, I went and picked Benny Martin up. And he said, and this was like 9:30 at night. And he said, we drove around Nashville until 5 o'clock the next morning. And I said, oh, you got to get me. He said, no. I just got to thinking, here I am driving your car. And my best friend is sitting right here beside me. And he said, what more could a guy want? So they sat there and drove that car around all night. Oh, my goodness. And when Kenny died, John was did some stuff at his funeral. And I was talking to John about that. And he said, well, there's a lot you don't know about Benny. He said, Benny never threw away anything. And I said, really? He said, no. And he said he had boxes. Now, I don't know this. I didn't see it. But I just remember what John Harper told me. And he said he had boxes, and they were stacked up. And the way you get from one room to another was little aisles where those boxes were stacked up.
Oh.
And little aisles between the boxes going to the kitchen and to the bedroom and to the living room and the bathroom. And I said, John, you kidding me? He said, no, I'm telling you the truth. That's where it was. Well, later on, when Gene Wooten died, Gene was that way, too. Gene was just the same. Gene Wooten was a dodo player.
Yeah, sure.
That worked for us for a long time.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that. And I can't remember who it was told me. He said, oh, he had little aisles that you could walk from one room to another. I said, no kidding. And I said, well, it was like that. And I can't remember who told me that. Gene Wooten was like that, too.
Maybe Benny was doing it. Maybe Benny was doing it to throw the mafia off if they came to his house.
Isn't that funny? I think that's hilarious. I really do. And he just thought the mafia was after him. What would they want with Benny Martin? Benny couldn't have done much, you know, to anybody. But he was, he was like this for at least 30 years that I know of, because I knew Benny at least that long and perhaps longer. And he'd say the mafia's, they're looking for me right now. I know they are.
Mm.
And everything I can do to keep it from them. I mean, it's just, I don't know why it was like that, but he sure was. And Lester Flatt said that Benny was just, he said, he's just Benny. That's all there is to it. He's different from anybody else. And then later I found out, well, that was the reason right there.
Yeah, that sounds different.
He was some kind of fiddle player. And he and Earl, they just matched so much what each other did that it was unreal. I just thoroughly enjoyed listening to them play together.
Now, did you see
him
play live together?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. I recorded, I think Bobby was on the place too. Benny later was on CMH Records, and he did several albums for them, and we were on, Bobby and I played on one album. I can't remember how many songs or anything like that, but we were on one or two of them, and he was just strange in the studio too. He was just a strange personality.
You know, the word that comes to my mind when I think of Earl playing live with Benny playing live next to him is loud.
I mean, loud?
Yeah. Wouldn't it be a lot of volume there?
No.
Really?
It sounded that way. I can see where you would think that, but no, it was still more. Earl had a way that he played, and he always played that way. And nothing change the way he plays. I don't care. He could be in front of 8,000, 80,000, or 8 people, and he would play the same. He never played light, never played real hard. He always played about the same. And Denny was about the same way, too. They both, when they played, I've seen other people like that, too. Chet Atkins, Buddy Emmons was like that. Tommy White plays steel here in town, was like that. A lot of people, Brady Mark, they played, always played the same. Same volume, same feel, everything was always the same. And they ever won, all of them, when they played, you had the feeling they were in control, complete control. And it was almost like, although they wouldn't say anything like this, neither of those people I told you, they were all very humble people, every one of them that I mentioned a minute ago, and there was four of them too, but every one of them almost, well, commanded, that's the right word, command. They commanded respect. They didn't demand it, demand, they commanded it. And it was there too, and everybody that I ever saw respected all of them like that too. Now there were other guys, there was a guy named Curly Chalker that played steel guitar, was a great steel guitar player, but he demanded almost that everybody just fall down on their knees in front of him. And he was a good steel guitar player, too, a great steel guitar player. But because of that, because of his attitude, he didn't get that respect. He never did get that respect. And Curly was a fine steel player. He really was. But those guys I mentioned, they were all the same. They were really easygoing, quiet guys, all of them. Every one of them just about the same.
So if Earl was playing, people just fell in line and tried to match his, his approach and tone and volume?
Yeah.
Naturally.
Just
kind of a natural thing, you're saying.
Absolutely. It was completely natural because both of them played with the same attitude. That's the word I'm looking for.
Okay.
They played the same attitude. And, every one of them was like that. Every one of them was like that. And when Earl and Benny played together, it was just like two guys that just commanded your attention and respect. And they got it. They got it from everybody I ever saw anyway.
Let me ask you about other fiddle players. That's interesting stuff about Benny and his mafia issues. But what you played with so many and heard all of them. You don't have to rate them like 1 through 5, but tell me some fiddle players that you really had respect for as musicians and band members.
Kenny Baker comes to mind. He was a really good fiddle player. I liked other people's playing better than Kenny, but Kenny was always absolute, right, dead on. I mean, he always played in tune, and he played with really great feel. And I think he was I know one thing, he was Phil Monroe's all-time favorite fiddle player. But he played Bill's music really well, too. Chubby Lodge was a good fiddle player. Red Taylor was a good fiddle player. I'm talking about people from the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. And, of course, Benny Martin would be in that group. Paul Warren was an excellent fiddle player with Lester Earl, Flaps Drugs. Lane Sprouse played with us, was just a great fiddle player. And there was a guy here named Shad Cobb. Shad, S-H-A-D, Shadrack was his name. Cobb. And he's still around here, but he's a little bitty guy that hardly ever says anything and is he's about as good as I ever heard. He is a very good, can play anything, and he hardly ever, I don't think I all the time that I've seen him play, I don't think I ever heard him miss a note or mess anything up, play out of tune. He was just one of those guys that can find out do it and play any tune in any key. And that's hard to do. That's really hard to do.
If you were going into the studio and didn't have, say, like your regular fiddle player for the Osmond Brothers, who would have been kind of a go-to guy? I hate to use that term, but who would you want to be there?
Oh, me. Probably Tommy Jackson. I didn't mention Tommy Jackson.
No, you didn't.
Tommy Jackson was just he was also another one. Dale Potter was a great fiddle player, but Tommy Jackson, he was just good. He was just a good, nothing outstanding. He played on all the old Ray Price songs and that Cajun fiddle playing style. He's the one that Rich made of that. And he could understand, and he knew how to record. A lot of guys are good players, but they don't know about recording. If I were going in the studio, I think I'd want Tommy Jackson. If I had a choice, I'd want Tommy Jackson because he just flat out knew how to record. And there's a difference when you get in the studio other than playing live.
Did you record with Tommy Jackson?
Never did.
Never did.
Never did.
Was it your preference to use, let's say, the Osmond Brothers band, whatever configuration they were at the time, was it your preference to go into the studio with the band that was going to go on the road?
Oh, yeah. We wouldn't do it any other way. We were offered, why don't you get this guy and get that guy. Now, we always used our guys, but then we added guys to it, like Hal Rowe playing steel and Ray Martin playing electric guitar. Playing piano, we always added guys to it, but we always used our guys in the studio, always. And my reason was that, you know, we couldn't take them on. If you had the best musicians in town, you couldn't take them on the road with you. And then when people see you on the road, if you've got a different sound, then they're going to think, well, you know, that's kind of synthetic. And so we use our guys, always use them.
Well, am I wrong, or does that happen more today than it used to, where you'll have, you know, a studio band that has a certain name, and then on the road, they're, other than a couple players, they're different, it's a different band?
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I do know this, that when anybody goes into the studio now, like bluegrass, especially, let me go back before that. Back in the 60s, when you recorded, let's say for Decca Records, that's who we were with during the 60s. But when we go in the studio, we book studio time, and you had 3 hours, a 3 hour session, 2 to 5, and that, like that. And you get as many songs as you can in that length of time. Usually we can get 3 or sometimes 4 in that length of time. And then you have to book another session, and you go in, and you could do 3 or 4 songs. So it took us 3 sessions of studio time to get an album done. And each time that you do a session, it's all unionized, and everybody gets paid union scale. Every musician on that thing is paid union scale, and leader got paid double. And so the guy would wind up making a pretty good haul for if he did an album with you. Nowadays, though, and I don't know who legalized this, who saw to it that it was done this way, now you can book a studio for a day, and you can get as many songs as you want. We've done an album in a day. And usually, now we always paid our guys. We paid them like whatever union scale was, and then sometimes over. We paid our guys every time we went into a session. I'm not talking, now this is after DECA.
Yeah.
And but now what happens nowadays is they just work out a deal where a guy gets paid so much for a day's work. And if they get 11 tunes in or 10 or 8, he doesn't make any more or any less. And usually they just say, okay, you get $150 or $200 for this album. Or I don't know how much they're paying now. I have no idea. But that's usually the case. And that way it's a lot cheaper on the artist, the guy like, and Larry Stevens doesn't do this, but I'll just use his name as a reference. Let's say that you work for Larry Stevenson and he goes in to do an album. He says, okay, I'm going to pay you $250 to do this album. Well, that's all it's going to cost me. And then his musician usually uses his band, and he's got three or four, then that's what that album's going to cost him, plus the day in the studio. And then that's usually negotiable too nowadays. It used to not be, but nowadays it is. And so he gets out a lot cheaper now than it used to in the old days.
This is just kind of off the wall question, but I don't have any concept of being in a studio, obviously, and the time it takes. But when the Osborne Brothers were really, and you know, I'm not going to say in your stride, but you know what I was meaning. When you were regular recording, and how long would it take you on average to record an album that you felt comfortable to release?
I'd say at least 9 hours in the studio. And that would be three different sessions. And then you would have a day or two to remix everything. And that's a remixing. I guess most people out there know what I'm talking about, but in case some don't, when you go in the studio, we've got different tracks. And recorders have like 24 tracks or 32, probably 64 an hour or 100. I don't know how many they have now. But and each guy, like a bass or a guitar or fiddle or whatever, would be on a track. That would be on his track. And then he would have a time before he would do his overdub, which back in the old days, you didn't do overdub. You did it all at once. But nowadays, a guy could go in there and spend 4 or 5 hours just doing overdub to make his playing. Maybe he messed up on the original and has to go back and change it. Well, he could do that nowadays. And so you figure another 2 or 3 days there and then another day or two in remixing, and then it goes to a mastering place. We always used a guy named John Eberly, who's in Dixon, Tennessee, and he always mastered ours. And when I say that, you have a remix, and that way it gets all the instruments at the volume that you want, and the guy's taking a break on instruments, he gets his volume up at the same time and all the tones and all like that. Well, then you take that rough mix to a mastering company, and then he has machines there that just smooths everything out. It makes it all just like velvet. When it gets there, it's rough. And then when he gets rid of it, when he gets done with it, it's just really smooth. I don't know exactly what all they do. I don't know what kind of machinery they have, but it's amazing how they can change. A good master recorder, he can change the whole tone of an album, the whole attitude of an album. And so I always went with our guys when I could. I always went to the mastering player and watched him do that and sat in on it.
Well, that's what I thought you did. You participated in the mixing and the mastering, didn't you?
Oh yeah, all the mixing. From the time we left Decca in 1975, I think it was, from then on to the end of our career, I don't think there was anything that I wasn't in on the production end of it. The mastering, the remixing, and the recording where the mics were set, how they were set. I was in on all of it. That's one of the reasons we left Texas. is because I wanted to learn how to do that, because I figured that the more of yourself that you can own, the better off you are. Like, if you don't have to hire a manager or a roadie, road manager, or this kind of guy, or that kind of guy, or this other kind of guy, as long as you don't have to hire them people, you'll wind up making more in the long run. And you'll also understand the business a lot more. And that's the main thing that I wanted to do. I want to understand how it all went together and how it happened, and so that if I ever had to, I could do that. And consequently, it did work out that way, because Bobby, for a time, Bobby had his own studio. We recorded a couple albums there. And I really got to understand how everything worked. And I'm glad I did, because it was altogether different than just going in the studio and playing.
You spent, and I know I've talked to you about this before, you spent pretty much time in the studio remixing or remastering that Live in Germany set, didn't you?
Oh, man.
That was on Pinecastle?
Yeah, probably 2 years.
Yeah.
Off and on, we worked on that for 2 years, and it was the thing was done illegally to begin with by the guys in Germany, because specifically they were not supposed to record, and they did. And then he made it available. Tom Riggs, who owned Pinecastle, I don't know how many thousand dollars it cost Tom to get that, but if Tom didn't buy it, he was going to give it to Bear Family then.
Oh.
And it was so terrible, and it took forever to get those songs completely to where they'd be passable. And I think Glenn Duncan helped out in so many ways. Glenn Duncan's a fiddle player that understands music and how it's supposed to go together. And there was a couple of places in there that it was just, we couldn't use it. And I called Glenn and told him about it. And he said, well, I'd like to listen. Well, he came and listened to it all right. But then he said, you know, I could fix this. And I said, go to it. And he did that, and that saved, I think, three or four songs that saved that we could still use. And then Charlie Cushman played guitar on that. The guitar wasn't loud enough or consistent enough, and the bass, I mean, it was a live show. And a terrible sound system on top of that. And it didn't have hardly any bass on it. We had Terry Smith go back and put bass on it again, on everything on it. And this just took forever. I worked on it 2 years. Just about 2 years. And finally it got to the point where that I thought, well, I think that's pretty good.
I remember when that was, when you were finished with it, and we had a discussion about how much time. Do you think that was about as much time you spent post-production, that's an overused term, of your time in the studio of trying to piece together tracks like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness, yeah. That was the hardest thing that I ever tried to do in the studio as far as recording, you know, making it passable. And the thing that came out was not very good, but Tom had so much money invested in that thing that he couldn't hardly afford to go back, and we had to keep going forward with it. And if I had charged him what I would normally charge somebody, I would have paid $250,000 off that. But I mean, it just wasn't the way it was. And I had people that went along with me on it too, the studio people. The guy at Hilltop Studios and Steve Chandler, the recording engineer, and John Everly from Americana Mastery, and Tom Riggs that owned Pinecastle at the time. It was just, boy, that thing was a headache from the word go. As soon as I found out about it, I told Tom, he told me that the guy contacted him. And I said, Tom, that thing is made illegally. And he said, well, what are you going to do, go to Germany and sue him? And I said, well, no, I couldn't do that. And he said, well, we just, between the rock and a hard place, we'll have to buy it and then do the best we can. And Tom didn't realize it was in such bad shape. Well, when we got the tape, first of all, it was recorded on German format, European, I guess it would be, which is different than we have here. And we had to, we couldn't even play the tape when we got it. We had to find a machine. I think Tom found it, or John found the machine in New Jersey, I think it was, and Tom had to buy the machine so we could play it to begin with. Unreal. Unreal. Every time I think about that, I get mad all over.
No, I didn't mean for that, but I mean, I just happened to know. I knew when you did it that you'd spend a lot of time, and since we kind of got into that studio thing, I just wanted to bring it up because I knew you put a big effort into fixing that up.
Yeah, that was a pretty heavy. I mean, and we, you know what? John Everly, the guy, he's in Dixon, Tennessee, by the way. There was one song where my voice just completely broke. I can't, it seemed like a Sweethearts Again or some song like that. And he took the line where my voice broke. He took that line out of the first chorus and put it into the second chorus too. And it works out so smooth. I can't tell you exactly where it is, but I think I know. But he just smoothed it over and to where you can't tell. You just can't tell where it's at. It's unreal. All the tricks, I think everybody used every trick that they knew in making that. That's CD.
Well, and it's right over there on my shelf. I just can't reach it, but isn't it two CDs and a DVD also?
Yeah, it is.
So then after you redo all the sound, then how do you dub it into the video?
Well, the sound is on the video to begin with.
Oh.
And then they just kind of, I don't know how they did that, to be honest with you.
You did.
And you know what? I don't want to know at this point. I asked John Everly, I said, John, this was the last time I saw him, probably about 6 or 8 months ago. I said, John, whatever happened to that machine that you had to buy to make that thing? He said, I don't want to talk about it.
Well, you know, if it came from New Jersey, it was probably through Benny Martin's Mafia friends.
I wouldn't doubt it. I would doubt they had something to do with it. Oh, my goodness. Oh. Well, all right, I'm gone.
You're gone? All right. Well, stick around next week. We'll find something else to chat about. I appreciate you calling in. Hey, I'm going to talk to you about Banjo-Thon sometime before it pops up next year.
Okay, great.
All right, man. Take care. I'll talk to you later. All right, bye.
Bye.